Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Our team is off for Memorial Day, so we've decided to put together a couple of great recent interviews for the show today, just in case, you know, you missed them the first time.
Later in the hour, we're talking about the 90s boom in black sitcoms. Martin, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Living Single, In Living Color, some true classics. PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett will talk about his new book, calling this a golden era of TV, and take a look at how the shows changed things both on and off screen.
And I'm excited to hear a few clips later in the episode, Cherry. I have a clip, however, for you right now about our first topic today, accents.
We will be sharing our knowledge and resources with the outside world. Wakanda will no longer watch from the shadows.
The two Utes.
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Item 3, play games all sorts. Well, I'm sure the children will find my games extremely diverting.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
So this is an interview that you did, Avi, about the subtle differences in how people talk, why we're hardwired to notice them, and how our accents develop.
Yeah, like why do Americans sound different than Brits?
Yeah.
Why do Philadelphians sound different than New Yorkers? And what unspoken rules have we written about these distinctions? Those questions are at the heart of a new book, Why We Talk Funny, by linguistics professor Valerie Friedland. And I started our conversation with a very easy test for Valerie. I want you to repeat this sentence. Don't worry, it's easy, it's easy. The sentence is, I ordered a huge funnel cake and a bottle of water.
I ordered a huge funnel cake and a bottle of water.
Okay, so let's break down your accent, because I didn't pick up a whole lot there, but I bet you did. What did you pick up from that sentence, and how do you describe your own accent?
You know, I think like many, many people, I feel like I had a lot of different inputs into my accent. And, you know, I don't have one that people call out as being from a particular place, even though there are some slight southern accent features in it. But part of my accent story is that I grew up in Tennessee, which clearly is a place people think of as accented. But I had parents that came from somewhere else. They were both French speaking. And, you know, at the time I was growing up, they were kind of exotic. And people sort of always asked them where they were from. And I think having that mix early on where we were kind of the outsiders, and I went to school at a school there where a lot of kids that were from outside of the South went. So I think that did dampen some of the accented features from the South in my speech. But if you ever get me either drinking or tired.
Which one are you right now, Valerie?
Well, I'm drinking, but it's only tea.
Got it.
I can't say I'm not tired. But anyway, it will slip out. And I think that's a lot of people's experiences.
Yep.
They have these different levels of their accent and maybe even different inputs. They've lived in different places. But really, the accent of home, the one we grew up with, those are the features that really define our authentic accent. And then we kind of take piecemeal segments from other accents as we experience them, particularly if we spend, repeated exposure to that accent. So if you relocated to Nashville and you're really with a group of people that you want to identify with, you'll probably pick up some of their features.
Absolutely.
Even though Nashville is pretty urban, so it doesn't have a strong southern accent anymore. But we are all kind of really accent savants in many ways, where we pick up things that are noticeable, but we're also not that great at sort of just picking up that whole, like, I couldn't move to Philly and become a Philly accented speaker. I might be able to say water, but that's about it.
Yeah, you would just get a little bit of a flavor. And by the way, on that point, here's a comment from Chris from East Hampton who says, I'm originally from the Bronx, but now live in New Jersey. Whenever I go back, I code switch back to my Bronx accent. So part of it is where you're living, where you move to, but also the context of who you're speaking with. And there's a lot of inputs you mentioned, Valerie, but the reason I asked you about your accent is because of your parents. Because in my mind, one of the big questions about an individual's accent is how much of it is society and how much of it is what you get from your parents at home. And you reference in this book this fascinating study about people in Philadelphia. Kids who moved before age four to Philadelphia developed Philly accents. But in addition to that, those with parents also from Philly were the only ones who were able to replicate all aspects of the local accent perfectly, while those with out-of-state parents, even if they moved to Philly very early, could not, which tells us that local accents start forming before we're even born. So explain how that could be possible.
Okay, so much in that to unpack. The first thing is this idea that as parents, we have a really substantial impact on our children's speech. And as anybody who's ever raised children knows, while you wish you did, especially in those teenage years, the really strong influence on children tends to be their peer group. In terms of accent, babies do really learn from their parents in terms of the initial system that they will have. So they get the input of the speech around them, which tends to be parents more than anything. And that kind of helps cement what are the categories of the language I'm going to speak, what's the sort of general melody. And even babies in utero seem to get some of that input from their mother. But by the time you hit preschool and you're hanging out with way cooler friends than your parents, that you really start to do something that in fancy linguist lingo we call vernacular reorganization, which is simply a big word for we start to model ourselves off of their behavior, and that includes language, which is why I don't speak with a French accent, even though that's what my parents had. I speak with the language of my peers, with the accent of my peers, because that's really the important aspect that I attend to there.
We're asking you this hour, how would you describe your accent? Let me read this comment from Karen, who says, I grew up in Buffalo, where the accent is very much like the Midwestern accent with a very flat A. When I went off to college and met up with young people from all along the East Coast, I felt regarded as a hick because of my accent. Needless to say, I lost that flat A pretty quickly. Of course, I'll add that when I first moved to Philly and somebody asked me where he could find what sounded to me like a towel, I realized words like towel and water are pronounced differently here. So really interesting story from Karen, and gets at that idea of social pressure being something that drives the way we speak. So let's unpack that a little bit. Why do we feel like, what about humans, what about our brains makes us want to conform to the linguistic norms around us? What would be the evolutionary purpose of that?
You know, if we look back in time, accents have existed as long as humans have been talking. And, you know, part of the development of accents is simply sort of the natural evolution of language as it moves through the mouths and the minds of speakers. So, you know, you think about maybe 100,000 years ago and language would have just started, and we probably had just one language, maybe a couple, but basically, we typically think it probably started from one language. Well, as, you know, 50,000 years ago, the waves of migration started out of Africa. Different groups settled in different places, and they didn't have iPhones back then, so they weren't calling each other up. No YouTube, sorry. So they didn't really see each other anymore, and their, you know, their survival was really dependent on being able to gel as a community and, you know, small bands of, you know, tribal members, and also recognize potential danger. Well, a key way to do that would have been to recognize someone from the sound of their voice. So even from far away, you could tell if they were one of your tribe or not. And if they weren't, then maybe get the hell out of Dodge, as they might say.
Yep.
Right. So these little changes that happen in our speech, and I think, you know, a great example of this is just the way, you know, the word water. If you're British and you're sort of upper class, you'll say water. But if you're from Philly, obviously you say water, or however a true Philly accent would say it.
That was pretty good.
Not too bad. If you're from, you know, a lot of Midland America, you'd say water. If you're a Cockney, you'll say wa-a. Well, all of those sounds, right, all of that sort of that T in the middle that we think of as T, it's actually not T in many accents because of some natural tendencies in the way that stressed and unstressed syllables come together. So it's really linguistically normal for that to change. But how it develops depends really on who you're hanging out with, and you'll pick up whatever version of the variant the people around you say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you accumulate a bunch of differences like this when you're all talking together, then over time, that's what we hear as an accent. And it marks social meaning and group signaling for us. And so part of that is simply in early times survival, because you wanted to see who was going to be collaborative and who may be dangerous. But it really also bonds us with the people that we talk with and flock with. And so just like styles of dressing and, you know, certain behavior traits that we pick up and cultural patterns from the people we love and we spend time with. Language is fundamental to that process.
It bonds
there's
us.
Very few things.
It bonds us to the people around us and, you know, in early times made us suspicious of people who might want to do us harm. And like, it's not the only thing, like you mentioned, there are other cultural traits, but this is a very fundamental one because it's something we all do. And I think it's really important to mention, as you point out in the book, it's something that we're able to pick up on almost immediately. Like, our brains are so good at picking up accents. Explain how good.
Amazingly good. You know, and we're not always right in our judgments, but we do, when we hear something that sounds different than we expect, we very rapidly, within about 400 milliseconds, which is about the time it takes to say hello, start to associate social clues that we get from accents, from the way that vowels are pronounced.
It's so automatic.
So that, you know, it's sort of part of our nature. And we find actually young children, so at 5 months old, we can see that babies respond differently to accents from their home versus accents that they're not familiar with. So it seems like it's something pre-wired in us to recognize these differences. And that's probably that evolutionary advantage of group signaling it offered way, way back when. But we're very rapid in making associations between accents and social categories. And, you know, that's not necessarily always a good thing because it brings up social triggers and stereotypes. But it also isn't a bad thing because it helps us recognize the shared experience of people that we have something, you know, linguistically at least in common with.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring that up because later in the show, we will certainly get into some of the downsides of our perceptive abilities when it comes to accents. But it's worth noting that this isn't necessarily a conscious choice. I mean, this is really deeply baked into our brains. I want to bring in a caller now. This is Will. Will, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your thoughts.
I'm a huge fan of your show. And
thanks, Will.
I'm from Minnesota. Thank you. I'm from Minnesota. And after the movie Fargo came out, everybody had an opinion about my accent. people in Philadelphia have been some of the nicest people about it because I think they know they have a little bit of an accent too. But everybody's always like, you know, oh, what's that, a boot and everything else? And It's just been really funny to be from Minnesota my whole life.
Do you think people assume you're friendlier, Will?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because that's an association that a lot of people have with Minnesota. That's a great call. Thank you so much, Will. So I want to talk about how accents develop. So part of it, right, is like some group gets geographically isolated and they develop a different way of speaking, right? But there are also some interesting kind of unspoken rules about how accents develop, and you lay out a couple in the book. One is sort of like ease of articulation and one is ease of perception. So when we're coming up with novel ways of speaking, there actually seem to be some rules governing like why we go down the paths we go down. Is that right?
Yes. And I mean, not rules in the sense of, you know, the schoolroom rules that you learn, like don't end sentences with a preposition, but more cognitive principles that we follow and articulatory principles that we follow. So ease of articulation really governs a lot of changes that we see in language and a lot of things that we complain about in language because it leads us to be more efficient in the way that we're putting sounds together in speech. And just like that example of how people pronounce the T in water, when I said it's, you know, when it comes between a stressed and unstressed syllable, well, it's more efficient to actually rapidly articulate the T in that context, which is why we don't really often say water, because that actually takes a lot longer. To be more efficient, it makes sense from an ease of articulation standpoint to just say either water, where you don't have the T, or something like water, where it's a much more rapid hitting of the tongue against the alveolar ridge, if you want to get fancy.
Let's get fancy.
So that's really what governs a lot of things we do, is just making them easier to say. And the trick is, if we just followed that principle, of course, the problem people would say, it would be, okay, well, if you always just try and make things easier to say, then they're going to be hard to understand.
Exactly.
But that's where ease of perception comes in. And so ease of perception guides us in a number of ways. First of all, it helps determine what kinds of sounds stick around in language more commonly. So for example, TH is a pretty rare sound in world languages. About only 8% of languages have it. And part of that seems to stem from the fact that it's really hard to perceive compared to other sounds. So a T or a D has a lot more perceptual acuity than a th. And so over time, languages that have th often turned them into t or d, and that's probably from an ease of perception standpoint. But also just in general, when we're doing that ease of articulation thing, we have a sense as a speaker of a certain accent or language of how much is too much. And so we allow ease of articulation to operate only so much as we can be understood by the group that we want to be understood by. Mm. And of course, the problem with this sometimes is that if you're not in that group, you might be like, I have no idea what you're saying. And I think the Philly jeet yet, you know, yeah. jeet kind of is one of those things like an outsider might be jeet what?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they might not get it.
It's right on the edge of being able to be perceived, especially if you're not in the in group.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's an ease of articulation, ease of perception kind of balance yep. there. And so these two principles really are fundamentally responsible for every single change we see in language, pretty much. You say
neither. That is the voice of Valerie Friedland, who is a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada. Her new book is called Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents.
We'll hear more from Valerie on the other side of this break. We'll be right back with more Studio 2. I like tomato, potato, potato, tomato,
tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you're just joining us, we've been talking this hour about accents, how the subtle and not so subtle differences in our speech are formed and the social meaning we assign to them. We're listening back to Avi's interview with Valerie Friedland, a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada and the author of Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents.
So far, we've already talked about some instantly recognizable accents, including some from our own region, like South Philly, Delco. We also got a lot of calls on this day. This is Chris from Chicago. Do I have that right, Chris? Are you from Chicago originally? You're actually calling us from Chicago right now.
Yes. I'm in Philadelphia now, but I grew up in Chicago. I've been here for 4 years. And the thing I've noticed about the accent here is that, and this may be a little elitist, but it's almost borderline wrong the way many things are said. I mean, there's no O's in water. You know, they're G, you're just skipping words. At what point do we consider this just wrong and no longer an accent?
Right.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great question. So this is so fundamental to the book. I think what you're going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, Valerie, is there really is no such thing as wrong, because the target is constantly moving. Now, the target that Chris is using there is what we might consider a sort of standard American accent. And we're going to explain in a second how that accent developed and how Pennsylvania played a key role. But let's address Chris's question. At what point is a pronunciation just wrong?
Well, all I can say is that spoken like a true Chicagoan.
Bears, yeah.
To say that, right? So, I mean, it's funny because a lot of people from Chicago don't think they have an accent at all, but anybody not from Chicago hearing someone from Chicago talk can instantly tag it as, you know, that's definitely an accented speaker. The reality is none of us think we have an accent if we are from a member of a sort of upper class group or middle class group that speaks what is considered sort of an accentless norm. Now, that doesn't really exist, but in our imagination, it does. And so we compare all other accents, especially local kind of provincial ones, to that one, and then usually judge them harshly for it. The reality is the same pressures, you know, that ease of articulation, ease of perception, and historical, you know, accumulation of small changes created every single accent of every single speaker, and every single person has one. And there is no such thing from a linguistic standpoint of a linguistically superior accent or something that is wrong, because if you look through the evolution of how every speech feature came to be, there's a long story behind it and often a history. And a lot of what people think are as wrong pronunciations actually historically or maybe even the older ones. So a perfect example of that is saying axe for ask. That actually is a colonial relic, and it's not a bastardization of English. People think it's wrong because of the associations with the social group of those who speak it,
yep.
But it itself is historically quite fine.
Yeah, it's actually in some ways a more conservative development of the language because it's conserving something that has since gone away. I want to talk real. We have some great callers on the line, but I did tease this, the American accent, or what we might consider a standard, I'm putting air quotes there, American accent. And you talk in the book about how it developed from the British way of speaking. And Pennsylvania really played an important role here. The Pennsylvania Quakers played an important role here. I would love for you to tell that story for our audience, many of whom are probably descended from Pennsylvania Quakers.
Yes. Well, gosh, that's a lot to live up to because you've teased how Pennsylvania is pivotal. So I better make it important, right?
Make it important. Know your audience.
Right, exactly. The Mid-Atlantic dialect region of which Philly is a part really was established with the coming of the Quakers, who were mainly from the north of England and also Irish, a lot of Irish settlers from there. But it wasn't just the Quakers that were foundational to the accent of the Mid-Atlantic. It was also slightly later arrivals from Germany and the Scots-Irish who came by way of Ireland, but were really from the lowlands of Scotland originally. And it's really those three groups that together forge what we think of as sort of that mid-Atlantic and even Midwestern dialect, especially, you know, if you look at the divides between the lower and upper Midland. What's really fascinating there is a lot of times, like in Ohio or Illinois, people from the north of those states think they speak a certain way and they, you know, look down upon the southern part of the state and vice versa. And it's really because as from the Mid-Atlantic colonies, the settlers spread westward. It was the Germans that stayed sort of in the upper Midland and the Scots-Irish that settled the lower Midland. And that's really why you get that weird divide through the Midland.
Right.
But in Philadelphia, really, the Quakers with their Irish and Northern English background were pivotal to the accent that would develop there.
Joseph from Middletown has been patiently waiting on line two. Joseph, you're on Studio 2. I'd love to hear your accent perspective.
Yes. So I was born and raised in Sierra Leone in West Africa. And so coming from a region in the world where there are so many accents, English is happened to be the third language I learned to speak. So living in America, they always tell me you have a strong accent. Well, in my mind, I'm saying to myself, if you came to live where I live and you try to speak any of the languages that I've been speaking so fluently, you will have an accent too.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where we come off with accents. We probably speak differently, but somebody has an accent. It depends on when you go to live in another region where your language is not the primary language that's being spoken.
That's a great call, Joseph, in Middletown. And there's a whole section of this book about accents for people who are non-native speakers and why they are so stubborn. I want you to try to explain that to the listeners, Valerie, because what's so fascinating to me is that we have people who achieve almost super fluency in a second language. I mean, they're incredibly, incredibly fluent. And yet an accent often persist, that doesn't go away. How does that happen?
My parents, for example, lived here most of their adult lives. They both left where they were from when they were, you know, 18 or 19 and lived in the United States for 50 years and had accents till the very end. So accents are very hard to shake because we start learning the system that will be the language we speak and the specific accent we speak very young. As we talked about, even in utero, you start getting that melody down. And then, you know, you go to school, you have these cool friends and you sound like them. By around 18 or 19, the system we're going to have as adults is pretty much set.
Yep.
And it's really hard to get away from some of those fundamental categories that we've learned. So which vowels we have, what consonants we have. And it's easy to move someplace and pick up some aspects of that accent. So I can, you know, move to the South and I can say y'all, or move to Philly and say water. I might even be able to articulate a few idiosyncratic vowels here or there, or sounds that are made. So I could go to Britain and say water here and there to sound fancy. But I can't do it systematically. I can't do it like those speakers. So in that study you talked about in Philadelphia, a lot of the kids that moved there were able to come up with, you know, pretty good approximates of the Philly accent. But if you actually measured how they were doing it, it wasn't accurate to the local pattern, which in Philly is actually very, very complex. And so what we find is people pick up parts of that, but not all of that. And especially when you come from a different language background, the leap between what you're sounding like, the sounds of your language and the variants, and the sounds of the new language is even greater than shifting accents. And so once you've had a system set in as a child and you've had certain sounds that exist in your language and may or may not exist in this new one, it's really an almost impossible task to learn these new sounds, and that's why it's really hard to lose an accent. You can be very, very fluent, but it's sort of, you know, the odd person out that becomes native-like. And, of course, we hear about them because they're so unique. They're like unicorns, but they don't really exist very often.
I want to read this fact from the book. Out of the 800 or so possible speech sounds found across languages, we typically use about 20 to 40 in any one language. So those 20 to 40 are kind of probably baked in, like you said, by the time you reach a certain age. And then if you're trying to learn a new language where there's a new sound or they drop one of those other sounds, it's going to be tough no matter how good you get at the language. Let me bring in another caller now. This is Allison calling from LBI. Allison, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your accent perspective.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Queens, New York. So my accent now is nothing like my accent when I was growing up or with my family, partially because I worked overseas for over a decade. But I find, even though I'm in my 50s, that there are certain words I struggle to enunciate or pronounce. For instance, the 25-cent coin is, I grew up the way we said it was quarter.
Yep.
But when I know it's supposed to be quarter or
No, you got it. You got it.
So it's like I go to like 1/4 or 25-cent coin a lot of times. And I was curious, like, if that's something that is prevalent in people whose accents have either been flattened out or changed basically because they moved to a different place, if there is that struggle to pronounce certain words that are different from how you were raised.
That's a great question. Valerie, do you want to take that? Because I actually did want to get into the sort of disappearing R, the New York, the Boston accent, and the British accent. But real quick, is what Allison's describing common?
Yes, it is. You know, I think a lot of us have that experience where we moved as, you know, 19, 20-year-olds, and we had a lot of accent experience, and we might sort of reduce the local accents that we had growing up a lot, but there are still certain things we get hung up on. And it really depends on the type of feature that you're trying to get rid of. And, you know, in the word she's talking about, quarter, and I loved Allison's attempt to do it with the R, we're talking about something called roticity, which is not just, you know, the chicken you eat at dinner. It's actually whether or not you have an R at the end of words. Basically, it's called post-vocalic R. And, you know, New York is famous for non-roticity or dropping its R. And so a lot of times, you know, that's something that's really low level and hard to stick back in there if it's not your native pattern. And quarter has not just one, but two. And so even if you've managed to reduce that in your speech, having it in two that are close together like that can really make it very hard to achieve in both cases. And I think that's why that particular word is so hard for her.
Let's talk about New York, Boston, British accent, the convergence of those three and roticity. I want to play this clip. This is Boston Globe reporter Emily Sweeney, who has been going viral recently on social media, basically because of her accent. She's talking about local news stories in Boston. This one is about a robbery of an $18 million mansion. Let's play that clip.
I interviewed the homeowner, Thomas Swan III, and he told me that the caretaker was forced around the house by gunpoint and was pistol whipped and was even dragged down the stairs by her hair at some points. Tom said it appeared that the intruder was familiar with the house. Several valuables were stolen, including a Porsche that was used to escape from the property. The car has since been recovered, but the suspect remains at large.
Okay, so the big question I have about the Boston accent, the New York accent, the British accent, because they have some similarities, is that the New York and Boston accent are associated with working class backgrounds. But the British R dropping in water is considered posh or quote unquote proper. Like how did that happen, Valerie?
You know, the story of R is one of the most understudied, amazing histories that we don't learn in school, but we really should, because it has a lot about not just, you know, our own history in terms of migration and coming from Britain, but also the way language works and what it says about class. So, you know, we think about our dropping in Britain as being sort of posh, but the reality is that it actually was considered a vulgar new upstart in pronunciation in the 18th century. And we actually didn't even really see much evidence of it at all until, you know, really in the 1700s. So when most of the early colonists to the New England colonies came in the 1600s, they brought their R's with them because R dropping wasn't yet a thing. And then it's not till the 19th century when it started to get posh in Britain. And that's probably because of some industrialization of Britain and sort of changing cultures and immigration that made class distinctions less remarked on, still remarked on, but less so than they had been. And then it was just so many people that dropped their R's, it became the prestige feature. And it wasn't till the 19th century that New Englanders, who modeled themselves off of sort of the cultural sort of cachet of London, picked it up and brought it to the New World. And so up to pretty much World War II, dropping an R was considered prestigious in the United States as well, because it was kind of this high-end New England feature. And that's sort of how it spread to New York, because the New York is sort of a New England corridor of development as the settlers spread. But after World War II, it started to change to be more towards everyman speech, towards middle American. And that's really when Midwestern accents kind of rose up in prestige. And so R added in, having an R became the prestige feature. And so that's when we sort of start hearing it as less statusful in American accents.
It's amazing to watch those two trends go in different ways up the social ladder in two different continents. It's a really important, I think, illustration of how there is a bit of an arbitrary nature to this, and social context matters quite a bit. I want to bring in another caller. This is Caroline from Philadelphia, who is on line 8. Caroline, you're on Studio 2. Real quickly, what's your question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Avi and Valerie. I've often been mocked for my voice. Some people say it sounds like I have a Philly accent. I was born in Philly and raised in Philly, and some people ask if I'm from New York, and there's very little you can do, obviously, to change your voice, and I personally don't see anything wrong with my voice, but I'm not hearing it the way other people hear it. And also, I was told I sounded like Kathy Bates, and my voice sounds very young, and I guess I should take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
So,
it's an important call.
I don't know. How do you hear it?
Well, I think it's beautiful, Caroline, but I think the...
Oh, well, thank you.
But I think the sort of broader point you're raising is the social value we attach to accents. And
right.
And so I want to get our expert, Valerie, to weigh in on that, because it's an interesting dynamic. I do think people who have an accent in this country that's considered working class, there are some positive attributes that people associate with authenticity. Obviously, the Boston Globe reporter we heard earlier, people love that. But if it's associated with an activity that we think should have a sense of authority around it, then sometimes people reject it. And I want to play this clip from NPR Weekend Edition host Aisha Roscoe, who has spoken about some of the flack she's received over the years for the sound of her Black and Southern accent. Here she is talking about criticism at a Vermont Public Radio event.
I appreciate and I recognize that a lot of people do not expect authority to sound like me. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on Gaza. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on the president or what have you. And so if my voice expands what people think of when they think of authority, then I am very happy to do that, right? Like, I'm very happy to do that.
So that clip and that call in concert, Valerie, the way people attach social meaning to an accent depends a lot on the context in which that accent is being used. And there are real social consequences. Can you talk about some of them?
Absolutely. And, you know, first of all, it saddens me that there is still that kind of accent bias in the world, that we would just go up to someone and tell them we don't like their voice. Mm. You know, it's stunning to me that that happens. The reality is, you know, every accent has a story, and all our accents are really the story of humanity. It's what bonds us, not just whether we have the same accent, which points to shared experience and friendship and commonality in the people we love, but also the idea that it's the same fundamental pressures that lead to all of our accents. And so really, it's a great story of something we all have in common. But yet we are so quick to judge people. And while there might be a, you know, sort of this natural tendency to notice accents that we're born with, that doesn't mean it's a natural tendency to judge accents. That's something that's very much sort of socially learned, and we pass down these ideas we have about accents. And we notice that children very early on not only are attracted to people that sound more like their own accent, but we also find that they're attracted to people that talk with accents that are considered prestigious wherever they are.
Right.
But things that we don't think of as highly, which is often the working class accent, they tend to get associated with, you know, sort of negative stereotypes about being lazy or uneducated, but also the warmth and love of family. So there's always positive and negatives to all these.
That was linguist Valerie Friedland, author of Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents.
Coming up, the golden age of Black-centered sitcoms, how they change entertainment, representation, and the country. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
Tell me that you love me, yeah. Tell me something good. You can do what you want.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It's the late 80s, early 90s, and there's a boom in TV sitcoms that are funny, real, and focused on Black families.
Gee, when Janice described him, she didn't mention that he was tall. Not that I have any problem with people who are tall.
My cousin used to date a girl who was tall.
Am I alone in this, or didn't none of y'all notice he was white?
I am ready to go. I got the slamming outfit on and my ponytail. She was saying, we're back. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, we all look good tonight. Yes.
She's a brick.
I can't go to no unemployment office, Gina. Somebody may recognize me.
There is nothing to be embarrassed about.
Have you ever been to the unemployment office, Gina?
Hell no, I got a job.
In a new book, PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett argues this was a golden era of TV, which for the first time offered full and varied depictions of Black life on the small screen. His book is Black Out Loud, the revolutionary history of Black comedy from vaudeville to 90s sitcoms.
Now, Bennett is a South Jersey native. Go ahead, Jeff. And in this book, he looks at how performers from Hattie McDaniel to Richard Pryor pushed social change, subversively challenged racial stereotypes, all while keeping their audiences, both Black and white, laughing.
We know Jeff from the NewsHour, where he's diving deep into national politics on the daily. So I had to ask him, why now would he focus on Black TV?
It's a great question. Thank you. And frankly, Jerry, it's the question I got the most when I was pitching this book to publishing houses, because the response was, you cover national politics.
Yes.
Why not write a book about politics? Why not write a book about Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any one of the past presidents? And my response was, politics is already so all-consuming. It really just works its way into every aspect of American life. And I have enough political coverage in my brain already. But the thing I had really wondered about growing up, I grew up in Voorhees, New Jersey, South Jersey, just across the river from y'all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd wondered about growing up, what was it about the 1990s where you had all of these different shows on the air at one time? So you had An Affluent Family on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. You had four friends, four young up-and-coming professional women on Living Single. You had the creative hijinks of a Martin Lawrence. You had In Living Color. We'll talk about how all of this started really with In Living Color. For Black folks watching them, they were a mirror. You were seeing yourself reflected in a way that was specific and true. For everybody else, they were a window. They were a window into experiences and lives that, and jokes that you might not otherwise have encountered. And I think, Avi, in the introduction, you referred to these sitcoms as Black-centered. And that's certainly true. But because they were so specific and authentic, they had universal appeal.
And the reason why I was so fascinated with the history of this is because earlier, you had shows with Black people in them that were not created by Black people necessarily, but the 90s represented an era of Black creators. How did the storyline shift? Because you talk about just what people were referring to, just the types of jokes, just who was behind the scenes. All of that shifted in the 90s, which makes it, I think, fundamentally different from earlier eras in Black comedy.
Yeah, there had certainly been Black folks on TV well before the 90s. I mean, yeah. There was Good Times, there was Sanford and Son. But to your point, a couple of those shows were developed by Norman Lear, who was brilliant, but he was not Black and did not come from the Black experience and was not representing that on television. And so that's what's so fundamentally different. You had showrunners, you had performers, obviously, and producers who were young, who happened to be Black or brown, of color, and they were writing from what they knew, and that was showing up on screen. And so take a show like Living Single, for instance. Yvette Lee Bowser, who created that show, I interviewed her as well, she started in the writer's room of A Different World. And Queen Latifah and Kim Coles had a development deal that really didn't go anywhere. They kept getting paired with writers who didn't really understand them, and they were giving them scripts that didn't work. And Yvette Lee Bowser was paired with them and said, I have this idea for this show of four women living in Brooklyn. They're all sort of figuring it out, but a couple of them have high-powered careers. And this is the show. And that's now what became Living Single.
Mm-hmm.
That show was important for a number of reasons. It created the ensemble blueprint that leads to Friends. And there was a character on that show named Maxine Shaw, attorney at law. There is now a whole lane of academic research that speaks about the numbers of women who were encouraged to go into high-powered professions because they saw that Maxine Shaw character do it first.
And Erica Alexander from Philadelphia.
By the way.
That's right. You know, it's funny. When I was interviewing her, she mentioned her time at Freedom Theater, and a light just went off in my head because I hadn't heard of Freedom Theater in decades. But yeah, it's
Leslie Odom was trained there, too. A lot of folks.
That's right.
Yeah. And I got to act because... And I know a lot of folks feel uncomfortable talking about Bill Cosby, Philadelphia native, who's had been disgraced over the past few years. But I can't not talk about the Cosby Show, because one of the things you point out in your book, the Cosby Show rescued NBC. It showed that Black sitcoms and Black shows could make a lot of money. And when you talk about this opened the door to the 90s, all of these Black shows being on air at the same time, can you and that white audiences would accept a Black show, and a Black show could be number one on air. Can you talk about the significance of that and Black shows equaling profitable as a major turning point?
And Bill Cosby's work starts with, in television anyway, I Spy.
Yep.
Yeah, goes
so
all the way back.
Here's the thing about Bill Cosby, and this is what I grappled with in the book. Mm-hmm. To talk about Bill Cosby, you have to hold two truths at once.
Yeah.
The Cosby Show was vital. It was key to television, period. Certainly this period in the book I talk about, which was the 90s, 90s Black sitcoms. But what he is accused of, what he served time for, is monstrous.
Yes.
Absolutely. Full stop. And so you have to grapple with those things. You have to reckon with those things simultaneously. And so for the book, I had to separate the art from the man. Because again, I couldn't tell the story of these shows, and I couldn't tell the story of the Cosby Show without looking at the art itself. To have that show be number one for as long as it was foundational and it was so important. And it wasn't just that they were an upper-class Black family showing the universality of that experience. Mm-hmm. It was that he was also infusing Black art. Think of all the art that was on the walls.
Jazz.
In that Brooklyn brownstone. And the jazz. Remember when Heathcliff Huxtable would go to the jazz club and he'd have on these jazz artists and stuff on the show, and Nancy Wilson was on that program. You know, I remember coming up and realizing that, oh, Nancy Wilson is a jazz singer? I thought she was an actress on the Cosby Show. So there are different entry points for people into that experience. There would not be a Secretary of State Colin Powell. There would not be a President Barack Obama if it were not for the Cosby Show. And if there were, it would not have happened as quickly. Mm. And that gets to the point I made earlier about the importance, the importance of the durability of cultural change in this country. Politics matters, policy matters, of course it does. But there's something to be said about the softening the distance between people and people finding familiarity among each other when they sit down in their living rooms with their families and watch these shows every week, night after night, for years.
Yeah.
You had this quote about Cosby from a critic from 1965, and I think this is the I Spy era, and it's saying about Cosby, his presence is merely taken for granted, and thereby more is achieved for better racial relations than by 1,000 propaganda exhortations. I think that was from a writer named Ben Gross. And it goes to like sort of the idea of if your goal, and Cosby did have this goal, of trying to advance racial relations and racial equity in this country, is it more important to just be visible, or is it more important to use your visibility to make a point or a sharper point than perhaps Cosby was making? How did you see that tension playing out through this whole history in the book?
That's a great question, Avi. Thank you. Well, in this book, I think both are true. I mean, there's something to be said about people don't want to be lectured to. People were not tuning into these shows for civic education. Mm-hmm. They were tuning into these shows to laugh. And there's something that was gleaned by laughing together. There is a cultural cohesion. There's a social cohesion by people just sharing a laugh and seeing other people as just like yourself, because your defenses are down and you're just trying to relax, watch a show, that sort of thing. So the visibility just in and of itself matters. And I would argue that if early days Bill Cosby, given the significant cultural role that he had, if he had come across as some sort of scold, or if he had come across as some sort of sword-waving freedom fighter, that would have undermined the work that he did. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't as if he existed in a vacuum, because as he was doing his work, you did have people on the front lines of the civil rights fight.
Dick Gregory, yeah.
Exactly. You had all sorts of, you had Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King Jr., of course, and like Malcolm X.
Yeah,
you had civil rights figures who were on the front lines, marching, getting beaten, getting hosed down by fire hoses, who were going to Capitol Hill, who were pressing that case. And that was vitally important. At the same time, though, you had those cultural figures like a Dick Gregory, in early days, Bill Cosby and Harry Belafonte, and the list goes on, who were working in concert on parallel tracks to push this country forward. And in so doing, really opened up the American imagination.
Yeah. And I know 90s was a big focus for you in this book. And so I got to talk about In Living Color, because that came out in the early 90s. And it's a show that brought together all sorts of really funny people of color and really changed culture. And I want to play a clip from that. Here's Damon Wayans playing Homie D. Clown, a disgruntled, prison-hardened clown who refuses to act like a fool for laughs and uses the catchphrase, "Homie, don't play that." Unforgettable. Take a look, listen.
All right, kids. I'm Homie the Clown. Y'all ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
All right, what y'all want me to do first?
Ooh. Oh! Hi, Homie. What? Do a silly clown dance for us.
Oh. Yeah! Yeah, degrade myself, huh? I don't think so. Homie, don't play that. Fall down, bust my skull open, have my blood and brains ooze out on the carpet so you can get a couple of cheap laughs, huh? I don't think so. Homie, don't play that.
And I love that clip in part because, you know, we're at a point, if you fast forward in Black comedy history, where folks don't, the whole culture has changed around Black comedy, and folks, you know, they keep it real. They're telling truths. You see Dave Chappelle come out. He's smoking a cigarette. I mean, telling hard truths. Can you talk about In Living Color a little bit, but also just sort of how we got to this place where you see so many different Black comedians and so many people able to be their full selves on stage and have a very mixed audience?
Yeah, David Alan Greer made the point that you could not have a show like In Living Color on the air these days, in part because if people were offended by what they saw, not by that clip, but there were some other really boundary-pushing sketches on that show, they would have to write a letter. And back then, first of all, good luck finding what address to send it to. And by the time that they would receive the letters of the network, they'd already been done filming for the season. But that show was so wild because it really was a business decision. Again, it was Barry Diller saying, "We're trying to differentiate and we're ready to take risks. And, you know, we had success with these sort of subversive shows. So we're just going to keep going in that direction." And so, you know, Keenan Ivory Wayans had come off of "I'm Going to Get You, Sucka," and had a really like firmly defined image in his mind of what that show should be. He had said that his writer's room was not a democracy, it was a dictatorship. He had grown up in a very funny family, so anything that got on the air had to make him laugh first. The second season of In Living Color is unmatched. Every sketch on that show for that entire season was brilliant, to include all of the musical acts. That was the other thing about In Living Color, was the musical acts. I remember I grew up in Voorhees, went to Voorhees Middle School, and the day after Criss Cross was on that show, all these kids come in, and this was a diverse middle school, all these kids come in with their clothes on backwards because they had seen Criss Cross perform the previous night on In Living Color doing Jump Jump with their clothes on backwards. So it was that kind of thing. Everybody was watching it. Everybody was talking about it. And that show also revolutionized the Super Bowl halftime show. Before 1992, the Super Bowl halftime show was a fairly run-of-the-mill affair. CBS at the time had the Super Bowl, and they would use the halftime show to promote whatever else they had on. So they were promoting the Winter Olympics. So it was a marching band. It was Brian Boitano. And Living Color decides, we're going to counter-program. So what they do is they come up with a 20-minute condensed version of their show. You can see this on YouTube now. And Jim Carrey at the start says, we're going to put a clock at the bottom. It's going to be about 15, 20 minutes. You're not going to miss the game. Just stay with us and watch this show. They siphoned off more than 20 million people from CBS over to Fox. Most people did not switch back over to CBS. The very next year, the NFL and CBS book Michael Jackson because they say, we can't have this happen again.
That was PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett talking about his book, Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy, From Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms. Such a great topic. Thanks to everyone who called and wrote in during those interviews. And thanks to you for tuning in today.
And thank you to our producers. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Hazel May Bryan. Today's episode was edited and produced by Paige Murray Bessler. Al Banks is our engineer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory.
From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.